When researching this podcast back in March, I took a drive up to Weaverville, California to check out the museum that contains the artifacts and ephemera from the moments that are chronicled in this show. I was pleasantly welcomed by the Trinity County Historical Society, who were operational on an otherwise laconic Saturday morning. I would like especially to thank Jim Satina for his help in locating a few source materials in record time during my visit, and also a few photocopied rogue pieces of local record to help me paint an even more vivid picture. I'd also like to thank Robin Ogata from Smith Mountain Cemetery for the illuminating information about the internment and ultimate relocations of bodies in Tulare County. She literally told me something that, while I assumed was a known factor, subtly is rarely discussed when this story is normally the cause célèbre. Without helpful and gracious and amazing people like this, I could never tell the story like I do. George Albro was 30 years old on July 24th, 1892, and had already seen a lifetime's worth of events when his job as Shasta County jailer would take a dramatic turn. He'd taken his first gainful employment at age 10 or 11 at the first courthouse in Shasta, California. He had witnessed the construction of the gallows and even witnessed a judicially sanctioned hanging there. He would become an ad hoc historian, devoid of letters but a master of the oral tradition. His career as a county employee would span 75 years. In the lead up to that time, nothing would prepare him for the event that would be the number one event to occupy and define his significance for the next 63 years of his life. The arrival of a lynch mob coming in to take two men under his supervision. Two stagecoach robbers, brothers, and also presumptive killers, culpable for the shooting death of a Wells Fargo stagecoach guard named Amos Buck Montgomery and the injury of two other people. Albro was helpless as a mob of up to 75 men with masks, described by him as, quote, 10 feet tall, unquote, took two men to meet a fate that would not only become part of Northern California's infamous photographic record, but would also serve as a cautionary and blurry line between justice and mob violence. We will talk about John and Charles Ruggles, known as the Ruggles Brothers, today on Box Number 7. Behind a glass case in the Jake Jackson Museum in Weaverville, California, hangs a pair of denim overalls riddled with shotgun holes. One of the few tangible artifacts remaining that testifies to the events of May 14th, 1892, when 31-year-old ex-convict John Ruggles and his comparatively unsophisticated younger brother, 21-year-old Charles, would bungle a robbery, kill a man, injure two others along the Middle Creek route between Shasta and Redding. Oh, and also leave behind the possibility of hidden treasure that continues nearly a century and a half down the line with regards to personal and human intrigue. John Boyce was already on edge as his Wells Fargo bank stage approached an area on Middle Creek Road known as Blue Cut. It was a hilly area that had been excavated to accommodate passages between Shasta and Redding, and for it was at that spot that he was actually held up a week earlier by an unknown assailant, but let go when it was determined his haul had nothing of value. But this time, it was different. He was alone on the first trip. This time, he had two passengers, Charles Sir, who opted to ride alongside the driver outside of the coach, and Ukiah native Amos Buck Montgomery, commissioned as a shotgun guard by Wells Fargo inside to protect the gold haul inside. They were also trying to beat an incoming storm. The Ruggles brothers got wind of the gargantuan payload and set about to confront the stage from Blue Cut. So Blue Cut offered an unusually large advantage in terms of logistics as well as intelligence gathering. The nature of the coach's occupancy could be seen from the top of the hill as they arrived, and plans could be altered in real time to accommodate any last-minute changes. But on this day, it was decided that the stage would be taken from both sides. Charles would come from the south side, and he would make the initial confrontation. Dressed in a mask, Charles appeared on top of the cut and ordered the stage to stop. "Throw down the box," it was ordered. The driver, who had Charles Ruggles' shotgun pointed directly at him, did comply. Boyce threw down two boxes. He would later, while recovering in a hospital bed, describe Charles's demeanor as, quote, "pleasant as a French dancing master," unquote. Literally polite in tone. As the second box hit the ground, though, Amos Montgomery shot Charles Ruggles directly in the face from inside the coach. This caused him to fall backwards and also caused his shotgun to discharge in reflex. Boyce's legs would be riddled with 13 different shot points. Charles Sir, seated on the opposite side, would sustain a few leg shots as well, but not enough to disable him in any regard. John Ruggles appeared from the other side and shot Montgomery in the back through a stagecoach window, 3 pistol shots. But he wouldn't die instantly. At this point, chaos becomes even more chaotic as the spooked horses would decide to cut bait without any encouragement from the wounded complement sitting up top. Boyce managed to stop them about 400 yards down the line. So the problem here was twofold. One, Boyce's leg was too injured to maneuver the brake, and Sir had no experience in operating any of it. Ultimately, they switched seats, with Sir attempting to operate the brake using his arms instead of his legs. A voice called from inside the coach. A mortally wounded Montgomery would yell out to ask if anyone was killed. Boyce asked him if he had been shot. Montgomery yells, quote, "My God, yes," unquote. He then asked Boyce if a robber was dead. Boyce told him that he had dropped him, but most likely wasn't dead. The San Francisco Examiner quotes Montgomery as saying, "I think I killed one of them," with Boyce saying, "Yes, I think you did." Chances are the truth of that conversation lies somewhere in the middle. Dr. B.E. Stevenson and his wife happened to be headed in the other direction when they came across the bleeding and wounded stage crew. Dr. Stevenson immediately boarded their stage and drove it to Middle Creek, while his wife would take their own stage barreling back to Redding to get help. Buck Montgomery would arrive at Middle Creek Hotel, where Dr. Stevenson would attempt to deal with the two visible bullet wounds, one of which exited his body and had also passed by the heart. 2.5 hours later, with his wife and 2 young children present, Amos Montgomery would step off this terra firma forever. Back at Blue Cut, John Ruggles would run across the road over to his brother, his face completely filled with blood from the shots to his face soaking into the cotton mask. John would drag his brother into the brush and then get his own axe, bust open the treasure box, and get all the money bags. Lastly, he went back to Charlie and methodically removed all of his identifying artifacts, as no one knew a thing about them as of yet, and Charlie was left for dead as he pleaded for his brother to save him. John escaped into the canyons. Charlie would attempt to follow, but was weak from blood loss and shock. He fell down into the ravine, into the darkness as a storm came in. Soaked to the bone, he lay there all night between bursts of movement towards Middle Creek and cursing everyone involved. 34-year-old Mary Ellen Stevenson's physical outline was barely visible as her horse coach and team of horses made it back to Redding through a blur in the center of town. Passersby stood in awe as an X-Factor skill level with multiple horse navigation maxed out to full speed made its way to and from Middle Creek Road outside Shasta. A search party managed to make it to the scene and, under normal circumstances, would have located the wounded robber. But the rain had already come in and washed away traceable blood trails, and it was getting dark, and the storm jettisoned any plans for the night. The next day, three young men, Harry Page, Nick Cusick, and Lloyd Carter, would ascend the graded route of Middle Creek Road to Blue Cut and locate a wounded Charlie. He would be taken to the jail and afforded medical care and be held until further measures were upon them. John Ruggles, however, managed to get away and had a wake of criminological history already behind him. He had already done time in San Quentin prison for robbery and assault. He was, for all points and purposes, dangerous. Although the community would have no idea that the robbery was conducted by two local workers from the Iron Mountain Mine, yet. Back at the jail, a sizable crowd gathered in the wake of the news that one of the robbers would be arriving, to the point that the officers inside became worried that a mob action might already develop. They put forth a narrative that the prisoner would not be there until that evening, but the crowd remained, figuring the information was a dodge, or a psyop, meant to get them to disperse. At 6 p.m., the posse arrived, taking what the papers called a, quote, circuitous route around the western suburbs of the city, unquote, to avoid the crowds. They failed, though, and a large group gathered, but there was no trouble. It turned out to be a crowd contemporaneously referred to today as looky-loos, or rubberneckers, if you will. A correspondent for the San Francisco Examiner was immediately granted access to an as-yet-unnamed Charles Ruggles while he sat in a jail cell. Protocols have come a long way since then, but the interview is nonetheless revealing. You see, he identified himself as Charlie, a former Iron Mountain Mine employee who had since been working jobs between Idaho and San Francisco. He told the reporter that his robbery partner was a man named Tom Horn, who was possibly German. He stated they planned the May robbery at what he called a, quote, 5-cent restaurant, unquote, on Powell Street in San Francisco about 5 days before the robbery. He said he took a train to Anderson, met his partner, and set up a camp in an area he could not identify during the interview. From there, he admitted to being in the scouting party and having his shotgun go off after being shot in the face. He stated that he heard other shots and said his partner most likely did the rest of the shooting. He then said his partner took everything off of him and told him he needed medical attention and then left. He recalled wandering around all night in delirium, his inability to swallow, and how his horrid condition gave way to relief when the search party actually found him and ordered him to surrender. From there, he gave the following biographical story. Quote, my father lives in New York and a brother in Arizona. My mother died in Illinois 6 years ago. I have a married sister in Chicago. My partner took all the money and had turned me adrift. I never saw anything of the stuff in the boxes, unquote. He then turned to the reporter and said, my name is Lee R. Howard. I was born in the city of New York and am 22 years of age. I came to California 3 years ago, going first to Tulare County. I am also known as Charles Shaw. So the correspondent then lists an arduous set of wounds on the prisoner, 12 buckshot wounds, 4 forming a semicircle on his left breast, 1 to the center of the right breast bone, 1 on the right side just below the elbow, 1 on the back of the left hand, 1 in the forearm and on the right arm, 1 on the bridge of the nose, and 1 at the corner of the right eye, and a last one on the upper lip. It was also noted that Charles Ruggles gave another statement contradictory to the previous ones, and it got back to the reporter stating that he was called Arizona Charlie and that he had, quote, companions, stated in the plural. It wouldn't take long before locals were able to correctly link him to his proper name, Charles Ruggles, and apparently affirmed, this was affirmed by a former co-worker by the last name of Hartman, a recent Iron Mountain mine worker. On May 20th, the brother's father, L.B. Ruggles, came to the jail and was able to elicit a confession from his son, Charlie. He also admitted that a capital sentence was most likely going to take his sons from him in this life. Other accounts say that Wells Fargo detective John Thacker retrieved the confession and not the father. John was spotted in Tehama County getting a haircut in the city of Red Bluff and then boarding a southbound train. John had managed to arrive at his aunt's in Woodland, and wanted posters were disseminated all over Northern California. She realized what he had done, and she kicked him out and alerted the local sheriff. Ultimately, John would be spotted by law enforcement inside the Opera Cafe on June 25th in Woodland, which is in Yolo County. When ordered to put his hands up, he went for a gun and had a bullet put through his neck, just like his brother Charles. And he would also, like his brother Charles, live to see another day. John was found with a lengthy, damning letter in his pocket, a long, winding diatribe that not only admitted outright culpability, but seemed to take a sardonic enjoyment in the speculation that Amos Montgomery's soul was languishing in hell. This is possibly an attempt by extension of an insanity defense that was going to come down the line. The boys would be arraigned with Dr. Stevenson and driver John Boyce testifying, and a trial date was set for July 28th. Within this time frame, John attempted to negotiate his release by telling the authorities the location of the hidden loot. John and Charles would also implicate Amos Montgomery as an accomplice. A calculated slander of a respected family man made to dilute their one impending judgment. This would not set well in a community already beset by robberies and roustabouts. The second aspect of their ultimate demise would be brought about by a phenomenon or condition that is now called hybristophilia, the romanticization and sexual idealization of those who commit crimes. It has been informally called Bonnie and Clyde syndrome and is a common scenario even today. Just think about Ted Bundy, Richard Ramirez, Charles Manson, Jeffrey Dahmer, and more contemporaneously, the appalling Luigi Mangione. All the receipts of an inordinate number of siren calls from the outside. In 1892, however, the arrival of an endless conveyor belt of ovulating admirers, hoping to feed, comfort, and consummate with these erstwhile Brad Pitts, was also the beginning of the end for the Ruggles brothers. July 16th edition of the Reading Free Press was already marveling in print that the brothers were not yet given a, quote, necktie party, unquote, and were already linking one foiled plot to the residents of French Gulch, outside of Reading. But, as they say, necessity is the mother of invention. It is also said that sometimes brute force supersedes meticulous planning. And in this case, the latter would prevail. So ultimately, it stands to reason that George Albro wasn't completely taken off guard when he was overwhelmed by a throng of men in the jail in the small hours of July 24th. He was asleep on the third floor of the jail, where the masked men awoke him and forced him along. When asked to produce the keys to the cells containing John and Charles, Albro told them that they were in the safe and he had no access to them. George Albro was blindfolded and placed in the corner with people standing guard. A combination of drills, sledgehammers, and explosives were used to open the safe. A safe which is now today displayed at the Courthouse Museum in Old Shasta, California. They got inside on the upper back corner after nearly an hour of incessant pounding. In their cells, John and Charles Ruggles felt the terror of what they knew was coming. Judgment. Right or wrong. As soon as the mob came inside the open doors, John Ruggles, with a trembling voice, asked them if they meant them harm. Charles said nothing. And two other prisoners, who had been locked up on comparatively minor charges, were cowering in fear, not understanding the situational parameters fully. As John Ruggles came out, he made his first attempt at redeeming himself in light of how his brother took all the initial brunt of blame. He said, quote, "Gentlemen, be lenient with my brother. He is innocent of the crime," unquote. He was summarily handcuffed, and shortly thereafter, Charles was brought forth and also cuffed. The newspaper described the accompanying crowd as silent and undemonstrative. As the men were marched across the street, through an alley, down the next street, another two blocks, and then to the left, ultimately arriving at Etter's blacksmith shop next to the railroad tracks. A wooden crossbeam was suspended from two pine trees in the system connected to pulleys. Two nooses were hung from the crossbeam and placed around their necks. Their hands were tied behind their backs and their feet were also bound. The leader said to them, "If you want to make a statement, now is the time, and be quick about it." John again tried to shield his brother from the inevitable. "Gentlemen, spare him." One of the other men asked John about an unrelated robbery in which a young girl was killed, to which John denied any knowledge. He was then asked about the stolen loot. Quote, "Spare Charlie and I will tell you," unquote, he said. Another voice said, quote, "Never mind the treasure. Tell us if you want to. If not, say what you want to say. Quick," unquote. John, having been quite talkative up to this point, refused to speak. Another rope was placed over his mouth to gag him from any further conversation. They were pulled into the air about 4 feet off the ground, and within minutes, their lives were extinguished. Photographer J.G. Franklin was there by the morning setting up his photographic plates to deliver a set of photos that would be disseminated around the country and world in short order. Both bodies facing northeast and devoid of life. A few variations of the photos exist, showing people presumably not a part of the original mob, standing by the still hanging remains. The coroner, H.L. Moody, had the bodies cut down somewhere around 9 a.m. the next day, and they placed the remains on display. The town came out to see the spectacle, men, women, and children alike. The newspaper accounts were a mishmash of empathetic as well as horrified in the following days. The Sacramento Union Record would declare a disgraceful affair and concluded with, quote, "The lynchers ought to be hunted down and punished as the law prescribes. Their actions cannot be defended," unquote. The paper went on to note that the sheriff and deputies were conspicuously absent during the event. The San Francisco Examiner's editorial made the case that while the lynching was in and of itself a dangerous precedent, that criminological statistics were already giving way to this in light of judicial leniency, sound familiar, citing that only two executions were meted out in light of 100 California homicides in 1891, and thus proclaimed the hanging a byproduct of, quote, "a sense of duty," unquote. The San Francisco Call weighed in, stating that the event was born out of a legitimate fear of acquittal and that John Ruggles boasted of having political pull at the ready to get him off the hook. And this isn't completely implausible, as John Ruggles had already been pardoned for earlier incarcerated crimes by Governor George C. Perkins after serving 14 months in San Quentin prison. He had been treated by a therapist named E.A. Stockton for, quote, "sex addiction," unquote, at the behest of Ruggles' father, L.B. Ruggles. Stockton convincingly argued that John was rendered an imbecile by his afflictions and addictions. For all points and purposes, an insanity plea. And just when you thought blaming sex addiction was a 20th century phenomenon, it wasn't, and I guarantee you, John's, quote, "debilitated addiction to reproductive gymnastics," unquote, and my words, was a well-known factor to the adoring throngs outside. It was 1892, and Jerry Springer was already happening. The Yreka Journal paid lip service to the extrajudicial proceedings, but saved most of their ire for the local women. Quote, "The citizens evidently came to the conclusion to hang the highwaymen from the disruption and sympathy manifested by some women bringing them flowers, soft-boiled eggs, and sweetmeats, which they can now spread over the graves of the notorious desperados," unquote. In fact, the closer one gets to Redding, the less sympathy contained in the editorial, especially when you got to Redding. The July 30th, 1892 edition of the paper rivals modern-day meme culture with its sardonically placed capitals, "Change of venue," followed by the alliterative phrase, "Ruggles raised right royally." Either way, and no matter the philosophical bent regarding the brothers, one thing is for sure. They were, as they say in the pirate vernacular, hanged until they were dead, dead, dead. Coroner Moody managed to find a letter on the person of John Ruggles after they cut the bodies down, one that gave credence to the hybristophilic claims that were disputed by the boy's father, L.B. Ruggles, who claimed that the attention of women was being used as a cudgel to whip up enough overwhelming community outrage to kill his sons. But the letter addressed to John said this: "Dear Mr. Ruggles, you will, I am sure, excuse the liberty I am taking of offering you the devotion of a loving heart, on which will prove staunch and true in adversity as well as prosperity. If you will make me your wife, I am sure I can help you out of your troubles, and when they are past, my wealth will take us far away where we can lead a life of peace and quiet and safety, trusting in each other's affection. You will love me, I know, and that you may know more of me, I will say that I am 19, 5'3" tall, expressive large blue eyes, wavy blonde hair, weight 145 pounds, plump and symmetrical in form, and graceful carriage. Friends say I am beautiful and winning in a manner and that my temper is sweet. Of course, I have never been married. You are my first love. Please write me at the Brooklyn Hotel and tell me when you want me to come to you and what you wish me to do. Yours, very loving, Estella May." So John, apparently captivated by this, had a response as yet unsent in his pocket as well. "To Miss Estella May, my dear friend. Your kind favor was agreeable to me, and I would like to see you and have a talk with you. My preliminary examination takes place on the 28th of this month. Hoping to see you soon. I remain yours, etc., J.D. Ruggles." The existence of this letter does not seemingly appear in any publication inside of an hour's drive from the locale of all of these events, and in my studies and in my research, I was unaware of it. I was happy to find it, as it seemed to solidify at least one account of a young maiden idealizing the bad boy. Then I got the strangest feeling about it. See, I wasn't searching for lovelorn letters out of a San Francisco hotel when I found it. I was searching for any trace information on the whereabouts and disposition of John's little daughter, also and coincidentally named Estella. It's a little odd, don't you think? It would seem, all things being equal, that a 19th century amalgam of prankster and ad hoc sleuth wasn't out of the mainstream, pre-internet, would it? The July 25th edition of the San Francisco Chronicle hailed the, quote, genius, unquote, of an unnamed charlatan that stated that he concocted the letters out of whole cloth, a response to John attempting to claim that he had a certain insanity that proceeded from being hit on the head by a teacher during his school years with allegedly irreparable damage. The letter writer apparently meant to short-circuit this defense by generating a sentient conversation with Ruggles, who clearly was articulate and able to write coherently and with purpose. It is my own assumption that the prankster invoked the name Estella as a point of departure, hoping John would elaborate on the name as it, you know, of being his own daughter and so forth, but I don't know. It's all suppositional on my part. His scheme was never tested, however, because John Ruggles had his neck stretched a few days after those letters were concocted. So, quat erat demonstratum. The brothers' bodies were ultimately given to their father, who had them buried in Tulare County. Interestingly enough is the fact that it had been assumed in a garden variety fashion generally that the Ruggles brothers were interred at Smith Mountain Cemetery in Dinuba, where they can be currently located or basically located. I visited there very recently and was taken aback by the fact that the name Ruggles is encased on a singular headstone with the word unknown under it, with anonymous gravestones to the left and right of it in a string of 10 or 11 graves in the same row. I got back home and was puzzled as to why such notorious burials would have such anonymity in a field of bodies that are predominantly not anonymous. Perhaps it was the infamy of what they did or a general indifference to who they are in light of the fact that they had committed such an infamous act. I got home and I went to the Smith Mountain Cemetery website and I sent an email and I received some very interesting information from Robin Ogata. By the way, this is chronicled in depth in a previous show about the Ruggles brothers' burial. You can look into that. It's just a few shows back. It turns out that the Ruggles brothers were buried in an entirely different cemetery in Tulare County known as Wilson Cemetery. And I have the cryptic surveyor data that presumably explained the location of the lost-to-time Wilson Cemetery. I figured I'd need to find some human Rosetta Stone or the man from Scene 24 in Monty Python and the Holy Grail just to decipher it. Because it says northwest corner of the southwest corner of the northeast corner of section 32 in township 16, south of range 24E, Mount Diablo Base and Meridian. In my mind, I said, good luck with that, Magellan. By the way, geocachers need not apply for this either. Then I decided to find out if an actual township map from Tulare County existed. I mean, I knew it did somewhere, but I mean without moving me to drive 5 hours back down to Tulare County and make an idiot of myself begging to get into the archives from an irritated municipal or county worker. But as it turns out, this guy, yours truly, who would have never passed calculus, figured it out. I found the exact plot of land at Dinuba where they were originally buried. It's now an orchard, and I'm going to guess the strange fruit from that tiny little land plot is, well, interesting to eat. But if you want to hear the whole side story, it's episode 55 of this podcast. The cemetery was deemed abandoned in 1945 with a hasty and somewhat discombobulated exhumation process that happened in 1947 that moved the bodies to Smith Mountain, including three deceased Ruggles. That would be John, Charles, and John's previously deceased wife, Ida. I was provided paperwork of a general assessment of who was buried there. John, Charles Ruggles, and John's wife, Ida Ruggles, are all assumed to be in the same row, possibly next to each other, with a singular headstone marking them in proximity to each other. So who is exactly under the exact headstone? We don't know. At least, I don't think we do. But we have every reasonable belief by extension of varied kept records that the Ruggles are buried there now. The assumption that the name Ruggles is the only one of the unknowns to even be marked has to do with the presumption that their previous graves were indeed marked somehow, or at least well enough for it to be assessed as to who they were. Interestingly enough, the names of the original mob that lynched the brothers never came to light, at least in terms of historical provenance. Chances are that many a drunken tirade in a local saloon echoed the names, recollections, and anecdotes from people involved. Is it possible that the men posing with the still-hanging bodies were part of the mob? Yeah, perhaps, but we will never know. Stagecoach driver John Boyce, whose shot-riddled denims are hanging in the Jackson Museum in Weaverville, would eventually become sheriff of Trinity County. He was pulled into a rather high-profile court case for Isabel Martin, who colluded with her son to burn down and poison the entire town of Weaverville, California, resulting in ultimate conviction. But in this case, she was acting as a disruptive and personal attorney for her own son in a separate barn-burning case. She cross-examined Sheriff Boyce about his involvement in the investigation. She also managed to convince the court to subpoena a ridiculous list of names, including Sheriff Boyce. At one point, she blurted out, quote, "Did you not tell me that you were one of the men that pulled the rope that lynched the Ruggles brothers in Redding?" Unquote. A stunning charge, but it was apparently not only denied by Sheriff Boyce, but not taken seriously by the court either, regardless of the gasps acquired in the courtroom. But is it possible? Sure. In fact, it's highly probable. We just don't know. One more addendum I need to add to the timeline, although, is somewhat anachronistically. John Ruggles' sociopathy is somewhat offset by at least the slight glimmer of paternal concern. John's father, L.B. Ruggles, came to visit the boys in Redding in June, and a conversation is recorded in the San Francisco Chronicle regarding John's lingering assets in Tulare County. Basically, John was trying to sign over all his deeds and assets to his father and ask that any residual money from their liquidity be put towards his young daughter, the heretofore mentioned Estella, age 6. Other newspaper accounts indicate that John realized his daughter was going to bear the brunt of the financial strains and mused about returning the loot so as to allow his land assets to remain somewhat solvent, as he was already in debt with his liquidity in question. Not a lot is known about Stella, but some reports say that she was placed with a relative in the Fresno area sometime between the death of her mother and her father's horrific demise. If anyone listening knows anything that happened to Stella Ruggles, please let me know. Then we have the man of whom I spoke at the very beginning, the colorful, weathered, experienced, worldly, and full of life, George Albro. The man whose procedural resistance against the lynching of his two prisoners was futile, and as we will find out, possibly theatrical in tone. At least that's the impression painted. In the 63 years that Albro would have on planet Earth to recount the fateful night, his story would change in terms of width and depth. Sometimes he would say there were 40 men, other times he would say 75, sometimes he referred to them as if they were biblical Nephilim, 10 feet tall, and guns to match. But what he would always say was, is he had no idea who was involved. Every field trip, every class, every lecture, every offhand conversation, those masked men were lost to the anonymous and abstract. Then, one day in June of 1950, 5 years before he would pass, he would tell the Record Searchlight that he does know who some of them were and, quote, "by gosh, I don't intend to tell now," unquote. Those last 5 years must have been interesting. Albro does have the standard Odd Fellow symbol on his headstone in Reading Memorial Cemetery, a frequent stop on the tour that are conducted by historian Ryan McCloskey. A fraternal nod, by the way, with the Odd Fellow symbol that indicates a devotion to a brotherhood and where perhaps the secret may lie. Maybe the truth of who performed the lynching is indeed an odd truth. But come on, he coughed it up somewhere at some time. Somebody has to know. Anyway, that leaves one more thing to be discussed. In fact, the thing that seems to entrance most people, the location of the stolen loot. It was clear that John made his getaway with the Wells Fargo bounty and that he could have buried it in the canyons below Blue Cut. I believe it's something called Henderson's Gulch. But what I figured I'd do is make my second departure from my podcast protocol to date up until now, with the exception of one in-person interview. The only thing you've heard for the most part is my allegedly flawless voice and dulcet tones. But for this subject, I'm going to defer to the heretofore mentioned Ryan McCloskey, who is not only a historian and not only a member of the Shasta Historical Society, but is also the funeral arranger at Reading Memorial Cemetery, where coincidentally jailer George Albro is buried. He's a member of a myriad of fraternal organizations, to include Reading Oddfellows Lodge No. 271, Masonic Western Star No. 2, and Reading Trinity Lodge No. 27. In fact, his fraternal connections are so complete and thorough, it wouldn't surprise me if he was a clamper out of the French Gulch chapter, but who knows? Oh, and by the time you hear this, you'll be able to see Ryan's participation in the most recent episode of Expedition Unknown with Josh Gates. Anyway, he is and has always been interested in the Ruggles loot. So I thought I would chat with him about this treasure, one devoid of clues, maps, or cryptographic concealment. I simply asked him, what are the prevailing theories regarding the location of the loot, past and present?
John's proclivities have often become lamented fact of local lore, but even more so in our modern time as we understand the criminal psychology and the things that surround him. And so, you know, having been convicted of other crimes, the circumstance under which he was pardoned, delving into other research that is not just historical fact, but that psychology has proven a great many things about John that allude to the location or locations of treasure. And so people took his statements too frequently at their face value.
So Ryan is under the impression that there was a certain degree of expectations and conditioning of a singular place, of a single pot of gold at the end of this meticulously planned rainbow by John Ruggles, and this may not be the case at all.
His incessant, "I will tell you where the gold is," and the semantics that the implications of the semantics that there is but one hiding space or place, and that this is that indeed material fact, is something that's been turned on its head. A great deal of access to newspapers that go across many counties, and other factors such as that do prove a difference in the narrative. And so, through the greatest undertaking of research, the biggest deep dive of not only myself but colleagues, we have been able to surmise that, you know, all these things in consideration, that John was a thrill seeker and a not undereducated man, highly intelligent, sly like the fox, of a certain type of criminal element that would control a narrative, not just to be pardoned, but for specific circumstances in particular. To better elaborate, we know that he committed a crime far before his mother passed away, or his wife, or his displacement from his daughter. But that is often the narrative that he would use in creating the image, the persona that was of a troubled individual. Those circumstances are what caused him to have the May 14th robbery transpire. But we know that he was of a criminal element long before that, and not because of financial reasons. He was not a Robin Hood. He didn't have an economic reason to perform crime. He had a thrill seeker's mentality. He simply liked to commit crime for the thrill of committing crime. These things are important because it does play very well into a controlled narrative. Psychologically, over time, it has proven that he was of mental health that is sound, but he would pull the card out of his pocket that these are the reasons that he suffered PTSD, or this is the reason that his mental health was unwell, going back to grade school incident or those losses of life of loved ones or so on and so forth. But the best description of John would be simply that, an intelligent criminal who was for the thrill of the game and less for any monetary exchange. And so knowing this, essentially John would have stated, "I'll tell you where the gold is," to free his brother from the fate that he was most definitely going to have. Possibly already confessing to his brother multiple locations of the treasure. And so that's where at this interval, the narrative has been turned on its head. Through Tehama County newspapers, it has been proven that there is a location that the gold was previously recovered in the same year that it was taken. Also in a Shasta County location, in a very linear fashion of travel from where the robbery occurred to other specific intervals. So as he traversed towards the Sacramento, where he ultimately followed a course to get on a train to head to Red Bluff to get to where he was ultimately caught in Woodland, you can see where a Johnny Appleseed situation could have occurred. There was enough time for it. There was enough intelligence for it. John was very calculated and cold-blooded in almost all of his endeavors. And so I think he was also someone that flew by the seat of his pants, and under circumstances, his form followed his function. His original intention would have most definitely been to have pulled off the heist without a hitch. His brother and himself being able to flee the scene with their gold, possibly splitting it up and going about their merry way. However, the circumstances of the event did not warrant such activity. His brother being injured, bystanders happening on the scene, no one actually being slain immediately would have caused him to have a little more of a frantic nature in how he proceeded next. But being intelligent, he could have rationalized very quickly solutions to problems. And so dispersing the money, I wholeheartedly believe, was his intention as things played out very quickly, knowing that he could confess to a hiding spot that was just a narrative of his own. And so having been aware of how the circumstances play out, how human Thacker, the Wells Fargo's detectives, may have proceeded, how other events would typically play out in a similar circumstance, this Johnny Appleseed theory could have fared very well for him, been pardoned before, the same. So to create a narrative where there is one hiding spot and creating enough time where he could confess one hiding spot and then hopefully be exonerated from his charges would allow him to go and retrieve other hiding spots that were not the one.
So if you've listened closely enough, Ryan is stating that there's a consensus in his mind and a few close colleagues that John Ruggles basically oversimplified to a singular location in terms of narrative, but that there was more of a modular approach to this, which of course begs the question, how many possible sites are there?
And so, based on my research, five seemed to be the magic number. And what if five were discovered? Most definitely three. So that does play different with the standard narrative, but faith gives us hope. Hope ends in fruition. My hope is that the fruition I will come to is that of finding the two locations of gold that have not previously been discovered. And so, in the year 1892, the three aforementioned that have been discovered are almost 99% proven fact.
Well, there you go, treasure hunters and people that take this as the most interesting part of the story. Do your worst. Take the inference. Take the subtleties and take the subtle undertones of what Ryan has said here and get your metal detectors and, well, good luck. Oh, and one last thing. At no point in this show did I discuss the viability, morality, or facility of the frontier justice meted out to the two brothers, one of which most likely did not actively pull the trigger and may have never had the wherewithal to kill a man. But they were unceremoniously hanged together. And for the next year, the blacksmith shop, the pine trees, and the accompanying windlass used to hang the brothers stood there as a silent testament to the events of 1892. And on May 17th, a year and 3 days after the robbery, a cataclysmic lightning storm would strike the trees and render them dead, breaking them down the middle. The pulley mechanism and windlass was blown to oblivion. No more identifiable iconography for the macabre. Was it a sign? Was it a warning about the extrajudicial proceedings that deliberately circumvented the jury system? Was God angry at the anonymity of the killers? An anonymity that remains to this day over 130 years later, especially knowing that the local Presbyterian church had its steeple simultaneously destroyed in these lightning strikes? We'll never know. but the nondescript site at the corner of Railroad and Shasta Streets in Reading today conceals a moment of extreme pathos, rage, distorted morals, and gnashing of teeth, and remains the launch point for the eternities of two young men, the avatar for 19th century Northern California, the death of the Ruggles brothers. And this is box number 7.